Thank you for joining our podcast. We hope that this message will both teach and encourage you. Here's today's message.
So last week I was recuperating. So the week before that, we had covered Exodus chapter 20, which is also called, where do we find in there? The Ten Commandments, also called the Decalogue. Deca meaning ten, loge meaning sayings, the ten sayings. We can name them real quick, right? How many of you know what the first one is? Have no other gods before me. Second one. No graven images. Third one. Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Right? What's the fourth one? Remember the Sabbath day. Keep it holy. Fifth one. Honor your father and your mother that your days may be long upon the earth. Number six, don't murder. Murder's different than killing, right? Unjust taking of a human life is murder. Which implies there are just killings, just reasons for taking human life. Number seven, big number seven, do not commit adultery. Number eight, do not steal. Number nine,
don't bear false witness.
Do not bear false witness against your neighbor. Number ten, in case if I didn't get you in the first nine,
no coveting.
What's number ten? Thou shalt not covet anything. And then it goes into some detail. So I call number ten the catch-all. If I haven't gotten you on the first nine. Now when we jump ahead to the book of Romans, we hear the Apostle Paul, who, by the way, what was his career before he was a believer?
He was a rabbi.
He was a rabbi of what sect?
Pharisees.
So he was an expert in the law and the prophets and all of the writings, the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Torah, you name it. He had degrees in it, and he sat at the feet of Gamaliel, one of the famous teachers of the day. So he was way up here. The super graduate of the highest education possible. And he was well versed in Greek and Roman philosophy because he lived in Tarsus in the heart of Asia Minor. So he had it all down. And so if anybody knew the law, Paul did. In fact, he would say it in the book of Galatians, concerning the law, flawless. In the book of Romans, he puts it this way. He said, in all these points in the law, I was blameless until the law said, until the Decalogue, till God said, number 10. He said, when it said, thou shalt not covet, sin revived, and I died. Because the idea of coveting, the first nine, what do they all deal with? Physical actions that you can measure and see. Number 10 deals with what? It's a mind crime, right? It's a good way to put it. It's something that lurks in the heart. Because he's saying, number 10, and don't even think about it. Right? Now, can you imagine if we were driving down the highway and it says speed limit, 70. And don't even think about exceeding it. Because we will pull you over for thinking about it. So you're driving by, you're doing 70, and the policeman pulls you over. Officer, is there a problem? Yes, ma'am. What is it? As you drove under the overpass where I was training my radar, I have another gauge. And it lets me know what you intend to do. And in there, it registered 90. So I'm going to write you a ticket right here and now for intending to do 90 in a 70-mile-an-hour zone. Ouch. we don't like to live in that world, do we? Say, wait a minute. Wait a minute, officer. I was doing exactly the speed limit. Yes, I know you were, but you didn't want to. You didn't want to. And so when we get to the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matthew, we find Jesus intensifying the law. Why? It's a little bit of review, and it's a little bit to kind of get us, because I always like to build bridges from back here in the book of Exodus into the New Testament for us to see the relevance of it, okay? So in the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matthew, as you read that, and Matthew is a gospel written by Matthew who is Jewish, and it's very much from the Jewish perspective. So at the centerpiece of Matthew, you will always hear about feasts and the law and the Pharisees and what they think. Why? Because it's about the Jewish response. It's a reminder of Jesus' Jewishness. He's the Messiah, so on and so forth. So in the book of Matthew, when Jesus goes and teaches on the mountain, before he begins the Beatitudes, he starts saying stuff like, "You have heard it said." Right? Now, where did they first hear it said? They heard it said in the Decalogue, the Ten Sayings. Then they heard it in the Book of the Covenant. And then they had heard it in the oral traditions and the Mishnah and the teachings. And so they have been hearing it said all their life. And he says, "You've heard it said, but I say unto you." So what's he doing? He's intensifying it. And then he takes this principle of coveting and he takes it back and he says, let's talk about murder. So let's talk about how murder starts. Where does murder always start? In the heart, right? And here's what Jesus says along those lines. He says, "You Pharisees are always busy washing plates and washing hands because you contend that what goes into the mouth defiles a man. But I'm telling you that which goes into the mouth passes through the body and out into the waste system. But that's not what defiles a man. What comes out of the heart is what defiles the man." And what they have been doing is constantly declaring themselves to be righteous. And what Jesus does is he says, "You've heard it said, but I say unto you, that if you call your brother a fool, you're in judgment. If you look at a woman simply desiring to have her." See what I'm saying? Jesus, what's he doing? It was tough enough to live under the 10 before. He's aggravating it. Why is he aggravating it? So that we'll give up the idea that the Decalogue declares us righteous. That we'll give up the idea that this somehow makes us righteous if we comply with it. What is this designed to do? What is the law designed to do, according to Paul in the book of Romans?
He says it's a taskmaster.
It's a taskmaster which brings us to Christ. It simply makes sin more exceedingly sinful so that we can see that sin is sinful. That's what its job is to do. It's to bring out this stuff out in the open so we go, "That's ugly. That's nasty." And he's saying, "That's right. That's what's in you."
But the law is not for the innocent, it's for the guilty.
But every one of us are guilty under the law.
Right. Because 10th commandment.
Yeah. So what's the job? What's the job of the law? It's to bring the hidden things in out. And so that we admit it. Right. It comes to convict us. The enemy uses it to condemn us, but it's designed to get us to say, But I can't do that." And he says, "Exactly, exactly, you can't do that. Now I have your attention. Now this means you're going to have to be in an intimate relationship with me because you can't just do this on your own terms, can you?" So I just want to kind of give you that background, kind of reconnect to some of the loose threads we've had out here flopping around as we've been talking about the Ten Commandments. And so now, yes, Matt. Right. The whole idea is to bring out the contrast. So you with me? Okay. So, does God know what he's doing or what? He knows what he's doing. These are the laws you are to set before them. So we have the Decalogue, and now what we're doing right beside that is we're going to go into something that's also referred to as the Book of the Covenant. Okay? Now, I've been studying and listening and working through a bunch of material, and I've come across this understanding and refreshed myself in this in some regards and discovered some new things along the way. And that's a neat thing, is you can keep studying the Word of God and always find something new. And amongst scholars, they typically have a lot of heartburn, and they're just not sure what to do with chapters 21, 22, and 23. Because it just, they call it a mishmash and a big mess of things, and they're not sure how to connect them. And part of that is because we look at this like Americans in the 20th century, 19th century, 18th century, or Germans, or Brits, and we say, this doesn't really fit in our culture, so what's going on here? What in the world's going on here? So what we're seeing is, how many of you know, in the sense of law, and this is universal, in law, you have the articles, the principles, okay, and then there's another important part that always is important in a court of law. Not only the law, the letter of the law, but what? The intent, and how's the intent come out? You have the actual law, and then you have case law, precedent, the precedents. And so here's what happens is you, first of all, you have the statute. The statute says this. Now, Your Honor, the way this has been enforced in the past, according to Vidal versus Gore, blah, 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 these dates, these times, this is how the court has held this to be so. So since that has been decided that way in these cases, this is how we are to apply the law. And under that claim, my client is not guilty.
Merits.
See, but they're using not the letter of the law that's been stated. They're using case law. And so we're not going to bog down here. We're going to kind of zoom through. And I'll just be honest with you. Part of me wanted to say, let's catapult over about three chapters and go on. But there's a part of me that goes, ooh, I don't want to do that. I might miss something. Okay? And so, and you might feel ripped off. You might go home tonight mad at me. You know what? I was all set to study the 21st through the 23rd chapter of Exodus, and Pastor skipped right over that. And so I don't want you to feel ripped off. So, yes, Matt. Exactly. That's what I said that's what the case law is. So what we have here is case law. Now here's the beauty of this. God is anticipating. Now here's what I'm going to suggest as we look at this. This is an insight into how they have been living and what culture they have been living for 430 years. They have not been living under strictly Abrahamic covenant law. They have been living as citizens of Egypt for 430 years. Now, for the last 100 years or so, it has been stinking miserable. But their whole existence hasn't been like that. But yet their culture was formed and shaped. So, just to illustrate that, what happens when somebody who lived in India comes to the United States or to Great Britain? What happens with their kids? They go to our education system. They learn to speak English. And here's what I love. Either American English, or what I love to hear is I love to see Indians who speak with a British accent. I just never get tired of that. I never get tired of that. And one of the fun, greatest things about seeing the movie yesterday was watching an Indian kid speak with a British accent like this. And I'm like, well, I love it. You just never expect that. So it's something that just delights me, because I'm looking at this kid from India. I'm expecting to go, oh, hello, my name is Bhaskar. And instead he sounds like one of the Beatles. He talks just like this. And you're like, no way. No way. So it's just delightful. I'm just delighted with stuff like that. Or seeing somebody who's from Africa and they speak perfect French. And it's like, oh, that just totally blows my mind. So I'm delighted. I'm mesmerized by stuff like that. So these people have been totally acculturated to Egypt, right? They've lived there how long? This has been their environment, and God is taking them unto himself. They are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but they have been functioning in Egypt. So if you function in Egypt for 400 years, what do you live like? Egyptian. You reflect that. You even walk like an Egyptian. So I couldn't. Yeah, Annabelle's sitting here. All she can hear is the Bangles or whoever it is. Walk like an Egyptian. So they tend to reflect their culture. And this is what stresses out the previous generation from India, when their kids don't want to toe the line of their culture. Then they want to choose who it is that they're going to marry and date who they want to and all this stuff. And it's like, no. We're going to arrange your marriage. No, forget that. I watched that firsthand. A family from Madras, India, which was a highly Christianized area, dear Christian people who can trace their spiritual lineage to Thomas, one of the disciples, and not because they knew him personally, but his influence in India. And then they moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and their kids grew up in Albuquerque, and they become 17 and 18, and the boys are saying, I think I'm just going to decide who I'm going to date. And mother and father going, oh no, we're not going to do that in our house. We have contacted somebody in India and we are going to select for you. And they're like, oh no, no way, dude. No way, mom and dad. That's not going to be that way. And they had to work through that as a family. That was quite a difficult thing. So is cultural change hard or not? Oh my goodness. It is brutal. We take missionaries and send them overseas, and they love the people, want to go over there. And what typically happens within 9 to 12 weeks of their assignment overseas? They come to a crisis, and they really have to decide, am I going to stick it out, and am I going to be a missionary, or can I not handle this any longer? Because they get culture shock, and they come to a point where they go, I thought I could hang, but I can't. I just can't hang. I can't do this. And they leave the country and come back home. So we do things to try to, but this is just a reality. People are raised a certain way. They're expecting it a certain way, and it's difficult. Churches have cultures, right? And we go to one church and we go, ooh. Well, it doesn't have anything to do with whether the Lord's there or not, and whether he's moving by the Spirit, but we just don't like how they do stuff. So it's culture. There's church cultures. There's family cultures and so on. We all get that. Now, so the Lord is anticipating here. He's anticipating the culture they're in and the culture that needs to be changed. Right? So he's not going to just take them and baptize them. They come up with a new culture. So what we're going to read in here, and this is what gives people heart attacks, is that they read the Decalogue and the Book of the Covenants, and they read about slavery and other things, and they go, well, I'm not going to serve your God because your God believed in slavery. No, not true. But he changed their culture, and he changed the context of slavery within the culture. Different. That's a basic difference. We're going to see that. So bear that in mind as we go in there. I know that was a long introduction, and I would like to apologize, but I have my voice back, and I'm enjoying it. So he says, these are the laws you are to set before them. And so now he's going to talk about how they're going to live life. Now, what's God's intention? That they're going to go from this mountain having received all the law and the insight, right? So the first thing was he spoke to them and he told them the 10 sayings, right? And now he's talking to Moses and says, now, let's give this detail and let's lay it out in case study. So how does this actually work in our lives? How do these Ten Commandments actually have bearing and meaning in our life? So when you read these next, as we read through and look at these sections, these next bits, now we're getting a glimpse into what they have come out of and what God is trying to take them to. And His intention is to take them from Sinai. Next stop, Promised Land. What's God's plan? God's plan is to go from Mount Sinai on a journey, just the distance that it takes to travel, nonstop, Jericho. And let's go into the Promised Land, right? And we're going to discover some things along the way of what God's original intention is. And remember, what God's original intention is often people excuse themselves from it or renegotiate it down. Okay? And it started in the garden. Okay? And it didn't get any better since then. So, have people changed? No, they have not changed. So, he says, these are the laws you are to set before them. Hebrew servants. If you buy a Hebrew servant, let me turn it this way. He is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year he shall go free without paying anything. So now, what's he talking about? It's a very interesting concept. He's saying indentured servanthood. What did they suffer in Egypt?
Slavery.
But now what are they going towards? The idea of indentured servanthood. What is that? They're like an employee. But there's limits on that, right? Look here. He's to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year. So now there's a concept here, and that is the concept of emancipation or freedom, which we're going to discover. Basically, I'll cheat ahead and tell you what it is, and that's a sabbatical year, which culminates in a jubilee, which is seven sevens, which then ultimately come to a jubilee. But every seventh year, it's about release. Reset. How many of you know when you get your computer and it bogs down and you hit Control-Alt-Delete and Task Manager and shut out down all processors, or go back and find it, just do a reboot. My mom called me on the regular house phone the other day, which I thought was unusual. I said, yes. She said, my phone's not working. So I looked at it. Well, it was frozen. Of course, that mystifies her right there. What? It's frozen. You know, yeah, okay. I said, this is a computer, Mom. What you have to do is restart it. Well, she was just hitting the button that makes it go blank and then hitting the button to come on. It's still that problem. I said, no. Hold it down, swipe to the right, power down, wait a couple minutes, hold the button in again, and watch the Apple come back alive. And wait, and then it'll give you numbers, you sign in, and it'll be fixed. And so it's like, it's a miracle. And I've witnessed it right here in the house. And so, so it's the idea of reset, of refresh, of reboot. And so, God had put in a reset that He built into the system. So He starts right off with saying, look, there's resets built into this. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he's to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. And who's he speaking to? Hebrews. And what had they been used to? Gathering straw and making bricks and being beaten and fed onion soup. How many of you know you can make a lot of onion soup pretty cheap? Boiling water and onions. And they grow right by the river. And it doesn't take them long until they say, were there not enough graves in Egypt? You brought us out here. Oh, that we could have some leek soup. It's the cheapest broth you can make on the planet. And yet they were desiring it. So they were desiring to go back to their known quantity, like the Stockholm syndrome of their pet. So if he comes alone, he says, if he comes alone, he's to go free alone. But if he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the woman and her children shall belong to her master. and only the man shall go free. So he's got to negotiate in order to get the rest of his family. Now, God is not saying, I love to break up families. He's saying, there's more that going on here, and so you're going to have to work through this. But if the servant declares, I love my master and my wife and children and do not want to go free, then his master must take him before the judges, and he shall take him to the door of the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl, then he will be his servant for life. So, what's happened here? This person wants to serve him, enjoys serving him. He's getting to drive the car at the manor. Right? I love my job. I get to drive the nicest car into town every day. It's not going to get any better than this. And so that they then indenture themselves for life. And how do they do it? They take an awl, put their ear up against it. Now, is this a picture of being manacled in the basement and being beaten with a whip and fed onion soup? No, this is the picture of an extended family. Isn't that interesting? It's the picture of extended family. If a man sells his daughter as a servant, she is not to go free as male servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreigners because he has broken faith with her. If he selects her for his son, he must grant her the rights of a daughter. If he marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights. If he does not provide her with these three things, he is to go free without any payment of money. So, what's happening in their culture? Multiple wives. But how do they tend to treat their wives? Like cattle, or worse. Right? And so, what's happening here? They have to change their culture. He's giving them, here's how you work out the Ten Commandments in the context of how you're living right now. So what's been going on with them? Are they polygamous? Is Moses polygamous? Mm-hmm. Many of them have more than one wife. Was Jacob polygamous? Was Abraham polygamous? Yeah. And so, was this culture? Is this something that God was going, isn't that wonderful? That is just the best place for way for men to live. No. When he found us, what kind of condition did he find us in? In Egypt, living like an Egyptian. So what's he doing? He's giving them a pathway that's going to actually relegate that stuff out, and it's going to transform their culture. So this, what we need to see here is a catalyst. This is now a catalyst. So it goes on. Personal injuries. Anyone who strikes a person with a fatal blow is to be put to death. Now why? What's the sixth commandment? Thou shalt not murder. What's murder? Specifically the taking of human life unjustly, unlawfully. So, by the way, you might get mad at me here, but it's impossible to murder an animal. I'm not saying we should go around killing animals wantonly. Please. Don't hear me saying that, because that's not what I'm saying. It is impossible. So these statements, meat is murder? No. No. Meat comes because of killing, but not all killing is murder. And so, murder is reserved to humanity. Why? What makes humans different than everything else? We think? Made in the image of God. So as we go forward, realizing that humanity, human beings, are imagers of God. They're imagers of God. Nothing else in creation is an imager of God. Only humanity. He says, however, if it's not done intentionally, but God lets it happen, they are to flee to a place I will designate. But if anyone schemes and kills someone deliberately, that person is to be taken from my altar and put to death. Anyone who attacks their father or mother is to be put to death. Which one is that? Number five. Honor your mother and father. Anyone who kidnaps someone is to be put to death, whether the victim has been sold or is still in the kidnapper's possession. So this is a capital crime, because it's theft of a person and a personhood of a person. It's a theft against them, right? Thou shalt not steal. Anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death. Number five, if people quarrel and one person hits another with a stone or with their fist and the victim does not die but is confined to bed, the one who struck the blow will not be held liable if the other can get up and walk around outside with the staff. However, the guilty party must pay the injured person for any loss of time and see that the victim is completely healed. Anyone who beats their male or female slave with a rod must be punished if the slave dies as a direct result, but they are not to be punished if the slave recovers after a day or two, since the slave is their property. Is this saying that, yay, slavery? No. It's actually putting a curb on what? Abusive. It's putting a damper on abusive policies, because they have come out of a society that thinks it's okay to kill a slave. So what is, how do you change that? Said, no. We're all imagers of God here. And so, you have to, your life can be required of you if you kill your slave. So if people are fighting, so are these people prone to fighting, bickering, quarreling, having conflicts? Is this new? Did this just start happening after they came across the sea? Okay, so this has been happening since the Garden of Eden. Okay. So if people are fighting and hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life. So if something happens to the baby or the mother, then that has to be exacted for you. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. I don't want that to come up. I don't want that to come up. Or that to come up. So quit it. Quit it. Okay. An owner who hits a male or female slave in the eye and destroys it must let the slave go free to compensate for the eye. And an owner who knocks out the tooth of a male or female slave must let the slave go free to compensate for the tooth. I'd be knocking my own tooth out. I'm just saying. Maybe not my eye, but you know, which tooth? Which tooth could I spare? It's kind of been hurting me anyway. You know. So the Bible is not trying to institute slavery. Slavery has been instituted since the beginning. What is the Word of God doing? It's challenging it and striking at the root of it. And He's going to change the culture of these people that He is bringing out of Egypt. An owner who hits a male or female. So this is where we get the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Okay? And that's actually a restraint. It's actually a restraint because people want to overcompensate. You cut them off in traffic, they want to shoot you to death. What would be evening up? You cut them off in traffic, and then they go, yeah, you're right, I cut you off, you cut me off, we're even, right? But that's not how it goes it never went like that in the lunch line. If somebody cut in front, and you kind of elbowed them, and then you moved up ahead of them, hey, get back here. And then it broke out. Then a teacher had to be there to intervene, because this thing got out of hand pretty quick. It began to escalate, because somebody would never push back with exactly the same force that they had been pushed. You always had to add a little extra. Right? And so, now, this used to happen back in the day when I was in school. And that is, if the coaches caught you, they'd take you to the gym and have you put boxing gloves on and headgear. And say, you guys need to work this out. And they would make you till you were exhausted. it didn't take very often and guys were like, this ain't worth it because the coach is just going to deal with us. And the other thing was they'd grab you and just give you a whack. And it just happened pretty quick. And it was like, I'm not doing that any longer. That is over. I am so cured from doing that. Now, I just saw people do. It was enough for me to hear the whacks and go, I just got it right with God. I'm not going to do that. Thank you, Lord, for Joe Berardi. He is such a fine example to the rest of us of what happens when you push the teacher too far. And so I just want to thank you for Joe, who's the guy that gets out ahead of the class and takes the whacks. And so, we were all grateful for Joe Berardi because he took it. And so we didn't have to. So if a bull gores a man or woman to death, the bull is to be stoned to death, and its meat must not be eaten. Now, isn't that a curious one? So is human life important? Is it more important than animal life?
No.
Is human life more important than animal life?
No.
Is human life more important than animal life? Yes. I was just waiting for I was just waiting for a yes from over there. Now, isn't it interesting we live in a culture right now that does what? Exalts animal life over human life, right? Exactly. You can't steal a bald eagle's egg, but you can kill a human being. Something wrong? Something's wrong with this picture. So what the Lord is doing is actually giving them anticipated, for example, this kind of stuff happens. I know you people. So this is how this law needs to be worked out. So the bull is to be stoned to death. Its meat must not be eaten. Why should its meat not be eaten? I highlighted that for a reason. I thought that was interesting. Its meat must not be eaten. There may be a reason that it gored. There may be something going on. You ever hear mad cows? So maybe you put it to death but don't eat the meat. Because there may be a reason that cow did that. Or that oxen did that. Or bull did that. But the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring, and the owner has been warned but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or woman, the bull is to be stoned, and its owner also is to be put to death. Negligent homicide. However, if payment is demanded, the owner may redeem his life by the payment of whatever is demanded. So the neighbor says, you know what? My boy died or whatever, but I don't want you to have to die. And they could actually demand payment from that man and he could redeem his life by making payment, whatever that might be. So is there mercy there? There's some mercy there. This law also applies if the bull gores a son or daughter. If the bull gores a male or female slave, the owner must pay 30 shekels of silver to the master of the slave and the bull is to be stoned to death. So slaves have a different standing than everybody else. You see that? They're actually being pulled up in standing, but there's still a ways to go. If anyone uncovers a pit or digs one and fails to cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the one who opened the pit must pay the owner for the loss, take the dead animal in exchange. If anyone's bull injures someone else's bull and it dies, the two parties are to sell the live one and divide both the money and the dead animal equally. However, if it was known that the bull had the habit of goring, yet the owner did not keep it penned up, the owner must pay animal for animal and take the dead animal in exchange. So he gets the dead bull and the live one. The live one goes over, the dead animal comes over to him. Negligence. So it has to do with how you live with your neighbor. Do you see how much care you have to have about your neighbor? It's not just about you. Isn't that interesting that that's happening underneath the surface here? This has to do with how you deal with your neighbor.
Yeah. He said, if it is to be an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, soon all of us will be blind.
Yeah. Because he assumed that people wouldn't learn from that by exactitude of equal punishment, which is why Gandhi is Gandhi and Jesus is Jesus. Right? Hallelujah. Whoever steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. That's pretty pricey, isn't it? So what is this designed to do? What's this? Sixth commandment? No, six is don't murder. Seventh is adultery. Eighth is don't steal. So property is important. Individual property rights are important. And if you violate them, it's not a capital crime, meaning you should die, but it should cost you dearly. Okay? Unless you steal deer, it would still cost you dearly. If a thief is caught breaking in at night and has struck a fatal blow, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, the defender is guilty of bloodshed. Because you can see him. Which means you can testify as to who it was. Right? So they probably prayed, let him break in at night. Anyone who steals must certainly make restitution, but if they have nothing, they must be sold to pay for their theft. So now they become a slave. Now they have to live in a family and learn how you're supposed to live. And they'll learn it as a slave. So will they learn something? Yeah. There's actually something that can be redemptive about this. If the stolen animal is found alive in their possession, whether ox or donkey or sheep, they must pay back double. Whatever they have to double it back to them. If anyone grazes their livestock in a field or vineyard, lets them stray and they graze in someone else's field, the offender must make restitution from the best of their own field or vineyard. That'll fix your wagon, won't it? If a fire breaks out and spreads into thorn bushes so that it burns shocks of grain or standing grain or the whole field, the one who started the fire must make restitution. Had anybody in human history ever intentionally started a fire to burn out their neighbor? Oh, absolutely they had. And so the Lord anticipates this, right? And he says, so if this happens, if there just happens to be a fire, okay, the one who started the fire must make restitution. If anyone gives a neighbor silver or goods for safekeeping, and they are stolen from the neighbor's house, the thief, if caught, must pay back double. But if the thief is not found, the owner of the house must appear before the judges, and they must determine whether the owner of the house has laid hands on the other person's property. Here's my stuff. Could you keep it for me? Oh, sure. Oops. Somebody took it. That had never happened before in human history. And so the Lord gives them case law. Okay, this is how this works out about this stealing bit. So when I say don't steal, here's some examples of how it is you don't steal. In all cases of illegal possession of an ox, a donkey, a sheep, or garment, or any other lost property about which somebody says, this is mine, both parties are to bring their cases before the judges. The one whom the judges declare guilty must pay back double to the other. Is this going to become a discouragement to stealing? Yeah. Absolutely. It's not just give back what you took. Give back double what you took. If anyone gives a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any other animal to their neighbor for safekeeping, and it dies or is injured or is taken away while no one is looking, the issue between them will be settled by the taking of an oath before the Lord that the neighbor did not lay hands on the other person's property. The owner is to accept this, and no restitution is required. He's got to take an oath before the Lord. But if the animal is stolen from the neighbor, restitution must be made to the owner. If it is torn to pieces by a wild animal, the neighbor shall bring in the remains as evidence and shall not be required to pay for the torn animal. So you have to bring in as evidence. They were pretty expert at knowing when animals tore stuff up. These people were trackers and everything. So, if anyone borrows an animal from their neighbor and it is injured or dies while the owner is not present, they must make restitution. But if the owner is with the animal, the borrower will not have to pay. If the animal was hired, The money paid for the hire covers the loss. So they even had leasing and renting, and they had rental contracts back then. Okay, so this is not new. You go to the rental agency to rent a car, it's like, man, they had to handle this too. Goes all the way back before Mount Sinai. Now we get into social responsibility. Let's see. Yeah, because we can fly through the rest of this. So we'll just take a break right there. And if you want to refresh your drinks to go to the restroom, we'll take a quick 5-minute break or an exact 5-minute break. Something that seems like it's 5 minutes, but it's longer or shorter. We'll crank it back up here again. All right, social responsibility. So seduction and sexual immorality and things like that had never taken place on the planet before, and this is new now around Mount Sinai, right? No. Okay. So we're going to get into some interesting stuff here and chase some interesting rabbits. That's why I see that highlighted space. That especially took my interest here. So if a man seduces a virgin who is not pledged to be married and sleeps with her, he must pay the bride price, and she shall be his wife. Now notice it says, by the way, this is not rape. It says seduces. He talks her into or gets her to. This. There's another definition elsewhere in the law about this. This is Dinah. Remember Dinah, the daughter of Jacob? She was seduced by the son of Shechem. Dinah was in on that. Dinah was not exactly uncooperative. And he wanted to have her be his wife. And then Levi and Simeon pulled the trick on him about, well, y'all have to be circumcised in order for this to happen. And so they all do that. And they're all incapacitated. So then they're all killed by the edge of the sword, and Shechem is wiped out. And Jacob laments that, because now they have made them a stench, and they have used something that was used to separate themselves unto the Lord as a trick, as a means of destroying these people in Shechem. So this was a real problem in their past. And so this says, he must pay the bride price, and she shall be his wife. Now all the ladies in the room are saying, what? What the bride price? What's that? Well, they arranged a value that you represented to the family that the family who wanted you would have to pay in order to get you. So it wasn't how much for the dress. It was how much dowry. You were valuable. A value was assessed upon you as a value to your family that you were seen by leaving as leaving a hole, a gap, a value. And so the one who wanted you had to pay that to your father, not to you, to your father. Daddy got the money, okay? So men were, it wasn't women that were wheeling and dealing. It was men who were wheeling and dealing over sons and daughters and positioning themselves in the society and in the culture monetarily. So he must pay the bride price, and she shall be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he must still pay the bride price for virgins. So, it was possible for him to say ixnay on the wedding. That's pig Latin for nix. We're going to nix the wedding. Okay? We're not going to have ixnay on the edding way. Okay? We're not going to have this. So the father could still exercise his authority and stop the wedding. But the man who had gotten the girl to be with him still had to pay the bride price. It could only happen one time, because now she's no longer a virgin. But there was a virgin price on her. So now we move on off of that. And what does that connect to? What commandment that kind of connect to? Maybe the seventh? Thou shalt not commit adultery. Do not steal, right? Or don't fail to honor your father and your mother, right? So there's a couple things going on here, isn't there? So this is case law. Okay, when we're going to talk about this Decalogue, but this is how it works out in your life. So, number 18, do not allow a sorceress to live. Now, a sorceress is going to be involved. What commandment is going to be problematic here? 1 through 4, but specifically, worship the Lord your God alone. Him only will you serve, right? So what does a sorceress do? Witchcraft. And let's drill into that a little bit. What goes on with witchcraft? Opening up portholes to other dimensions, dealing with unclean spirits. Okay, summoning up spirits. So now we're getting into the occult. We're getting into the dark arts. This stuff's real, folks, by the way. It's real. It's always been real. Okay? This stuff is real stuff. Now, we don't need to be afraid of it, but we don't need to mess with it either. Okay? But this stuff's real stuff. And so he says there's only one answer for a sorceress. Death. Because there's nothing good that can come out of this. And have they been around this? Where did they just come from? And in Egypt, what was going on? Magicians of Pharaoh? Talk about sorcery and sorceresses. This was going on. Probably. Yeah, probably. But then the accusation was a whole other thing. But do not allow sorcerers to live, because this is somebody who's going to pull you away from worshiping the Lord your God and Him only serving, right? Number 19. Anyone who has sexual relations with an animal is to be put to death. This is bestiality. Now, why in the world is this mentioned here? And interestingly enough, why does it show up right after the sorceress?
You're going back to the Nephilim. Antediluvian.
We're starting to connect to something we talked about before.
Antediluvian.
And before the flood, in the book of Genesis, the 6th chapter, verses 1 through 5, talks about all flesh has become corrupted before me, right? And it talks about Nephilim, talks about giant offspring, so on and so forth. And so what you find, interestingly enough, in Greek and Roman mythology is what?
Men and animals.
Mixture of men and animals. If you read the book of Enoch, by the way, both the book of Enoch and Jasher and a couple others, Jubilee, a couple others actually were included in the first printing of the 1611 King James Version Bible. So, what's that? There you go. It was included in most Bibles till the 1960s. English Bibles included these what was called apocryphal books. And in these apocryphal books, you get this imagery of fallen angels manipulating and dealing with genetics and involving themselves with animals as well as men and getting what's called chimera. You'll see it this way, and sometimes you'll see it this way. What is that? Hybrid offspring. And it's argued that this was one of the reasons the earth was flooded at the judgment of Noah. So what is going on in Egypt? What's been going on in the Israeli culture that they've been living in Egypt? What are they familiar with? They're familiar with witchcraft and sorcery. They're also familiar with cultic rituals involving sex and animals. And what is the... I'm not saying they're being successful, but what is the desire of earthly religion after the flood of Noah? What are they constantly trying to do? What's the problem with Nimrod and at the Tower of Babel? What are they constantly trying to do? They're trying to get back to the glory days of how it was before the flood and when this stuff was going on. The stories live on. These were glory days. Okay? and they were trying to get back to that. Ancestor worship was a part of it, and the other one was trying to link up with the unseen realm through ritual acts of sexuality and occultic ritual and bloodletting in order for this to happen. And so as you look back over Earth history, you find this continuously amongst these different religions, all of this come together. Now I'll fast forward a little bit. We're all adults here, and I'm not going to get graphic, of course. But you move up to, how many of you have heard the town Caesarea Philippi? How many of you have been to Caesarea Philippi? How many of you have stumbled off a curb at Caesarea Philippi? I'm sorry, David, I couldn't resist. Hey, there's been a lot of people who have been Caesarea Philippi, but not everybody's managed. And it was wet. Let's be fair. It was wet and that day. And so, anyway, he will never forget Caesarea Philippi. I'm just saying. He will never. It was a totally memorable occasion. So up there, we stood there, and it's at the base of Mount Hermon, the mountain there of Mount Hermon. By the way, Mount Hermon is the mountain that's named in the book of Enoch is the place that the 200 angels that were fallen came down and began to affect mankind. So that's according to the book of Enoch. But there we stand at the base of that mount, same Mount Hermon, and there was water that used to gush up until an earthquake back in the 1800s. There was water that used to gush up out of a cavern right there and flow down and making one of the tributaries into the Jordan River. And it came right up under, and built over that by Herod, the builder, was a shrine to one of the Roman gods. And they would make live sacrifices every day at that water. They believed that that was coming out from Sheol, or the place of the dead, and Hades. So when Jesus describes it, he says, I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. Jesus is standing there at this pagan ritual place. Now, one of the other things that occurs there is it's also called Mount, not only Mount Hermon, but in the Syrians, it's called Mount Sirius. It's also called Mount Boniel or Mount Poniel. Pan. Ah. And one of the major worship going on there was the worship of the Greek god Pan, and Pan was half man and half deer or goat. Goat. He was a goat man. And part of the ritual of worshiping on the mountain was sexual relationship with goats. Okay? So it was horrible. But this was part of the desire to be in communion with and connection with and to call back into existence and open the door for manifestation of this Greek god Pan. This whole region was dedicated to it. Okay? Now Jesus is standing in some of the biggest, it's a different stripe of it, but it's great darkness. He's standing on the edge. It's like standing on Chartres Street during Mardi Gras. Okay? It's like this place is dark with all of the witchcraft stores and all the other stuff. And so he's standing here, and this is where he says, on this rock of who I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. I will build my church, and the gate of Hades will not stop it, will not prevail against it. And so that was such a positive statement, but he's making that statement in an atmosphere that is charged with darkness and is committed to this kind of occultism and darkness. The tribe of Dan got sucked into it and really messed up, and the Syrians were really messed up. And then when you read in the Gospels, watch very carefully where when Jesus is ministering in Galilee, watch very carefully where the demoniacs tend to come from. That area. The Syrians, they are the people from that area. It says that They were laid in the streets of Capernaum, and Jesus went and cast the devils out of them. Where did that happen? They were involved in the cultic witchcraft in Caesarea Philippi at all of those shrines, and this was what was going on with them. So, he says, so anyone who has sexual relations with an animal is to be put to death. There's more than meets the eye here. Because in Egypt, as well as into the land of Canaan, what has been going on for hundreds of years? What have the Canaanites been doing? The very same stuff. And he's saying, you can't have anything to do with this. So this is as much about, you don't have any other gods before me, as it is about anything else. Not to mention the diseases and everything else that come as a result of it. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord must be destroyed. Now this is an interesting word, this word destroyed. Because this has to do with being set aside unto the Lord for destruction. It's seen as a judgment of God upon that person. And somebody who gets in trouble in a slightly different way we're going to encounter later, I'll cheat ahead and tell you, is a man who takes a Babylonian garment, some silver and some gold, and hides it in his tent outside of Jericho. And it says of Achan that he had touched the devoted thing. It's that which had been set aside to be destroyed in the name of God. And so he takes this very seriously. He says, if you sacrifice to any god other than the Lord, they must be destroyed, counted and set aside for destruction in the name of the Lord. Okay? Now he goes on. Do not mistreat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. So you understand what it's like to be foreigners, right? So have some sympathy for people who are now going to be around you and don't fit in. By the way, when they left Egypt, who was with them? They brought some Egyptians and some others. Some other people came with them. And now they're going to build a new culture that's foreign to these people. And so they're saying, don't mistreat or oppress a foreigner. And isn't it interesting? That's just a human nature thing, isn't it? What do you do with the new kid when they come to the school? Most of the time, you run them through the rack. Okay? You prove him out. He has to run the gauntlet because he's not from around here. What happens if you're sitting around a campfire and somebody says they got their salsa from New York City? Get a rope. New York City, and you get a rope, right? So he's saying, don't mistreat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. So you're going to have to be sympathetic. You have to understand their plight, and you're going to have to deal with them with some compassion. Do not take advantage of the widow or the fatherless. Who are the most vulnerable people in any society? Widows and orphans, right? Because they did not have any rights. What gave them worth and value was if they had a father, not a mother, a father. You could be counted an orphan if you had a mom but not a dad. So having a husband, having a father, this is what gave you heirship, it gave you rights, and so on and so forth. It had a sense of significance in the society. But when those were gone, you didn't really count. And what did people typically do with people who didn't really count? Take advantage of them. Rip them off because they're helpless. They have no standing. And so he says, don't take advantage of them. So he's given them a law, and now he's saying, don't take advantage.
Which is why police and fire departments have widows and orphans funds.
Right.
But
you go to Calcutta, India, they throw the orphans in the street. You go to Guatemala, you go to the colonias around in Honduras and other places, and they just get rid of the kids. We have five kids, now we have the sixth kid, and so we take the oldest two and we throw them out in the street because we got to take care of these four, and so then they're out just fending for themselves. What happens to them? They become human human traffic. They're trafficked in the Philippines. They're trafficked in Hong Kong. They're trafficked in China and other places. These kids are trafficked. And so what do we have is we have a major problem right now in the world with human trafficking, specifically with children. Right? They have no one to speak for them. And, by the way, just my little shameless commercial, Jeffrey Epstein did not kill himself. There is this strange connection, and I'm telling you, it's everywhere, and it's in the United States too. There is a strange connection between people in power and taking advantage of children and using them and satanic ritual. Those three things go together. And we have some of the highest people in our government right now in the United States who are deeply involved in the occult worship, spirit cooking, pedophilia, and they're connected deeply. If that thing ever comes open, it will be amazing how deeply it goes and where it goes. And I'm telling you, this is historic. This is not new. This happened in the Third Reich. This happens in governments. This happened in kingships. This happens. This happened time after time after time after time. And the Lord is pointing it out to them. This was a problem in Egypt. This was a problem in these godless societies that linked taking the innocence of children and gaining power from it and pleasing a god of the region. The people of Israel would later take some of their children and cause them to pass through the fire to Molech. And so this stuff, I'm telling you, gaining power, pedophilia, abusing children, and this stuff is intimately connected. And what's the Lord trying to do? Trying to break that link. He's trying to break that yoke. Yeah, you shot a hand up back here. This is one of the primary tasks of the church that they see in the book of James. And in the book of a book of Acts. So, to visit the widows in their affliction and take care of the orphans. So, it goes way back here, and we just have to understand these people were taken advantage of, but they were also used and abused and thrown away culturally for thousands of years. He says, if you do and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. Jesus would later say, if you get in the way of one of these little children, it would be better for you if a large millstone was put around your neck and you were tossed into the middle of the sea. This is something that specifically is very offensive, and I'm going to deal with it. Yeah. Well, it has to do with the depth of the occultism and spiritism that it connects to. It's very dark. Very, very dark.
And also, if you throw children out and do all that stuff, That's how a lot of the street gangs...
Exactly. Fatherlessness leads to gangs, which leads to additional poverty, and it just becomes a vicious cycle. It's just violence. So, he said, my anger will be aroused and I will kill you. Now listen to what the Lord says he would do. If you do this as a society, if you turn a blind eye to this, I will certainly hear their cry, and my anger will be aroused, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows, and your children fatherless. Ouch. If you lend money, so now he's going to go on to lending money. Back to, this is the value part, this is mixture back here, what we just covered. Of the value of human beings, because what? They're imagers of God, right? The value that he places on them. And secondly, not having any other gods before him. Because very often this was tied into religion. So, if you lend money, how many of you need a loan? No, I'm just kidding. If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not treat it like a business deal. Okay. Charge no interest. Now he says, now lending money means I'm going to give you this money and then you'll repay me, right? Now what does it mean to charge interest?
You're making money on the deal.
Yeah, you're making money on the money. So you loan them five, you get 10. Right? So now it's a business deal. It's not lending. It's not trying to take care of somebody. It's taking advantage of somebody's predicament and getting wealthy off it. This is one thing that just irritates me to no end about high interest loans. Because the very people who need the help can't dig out from the help because they can't qualify for a lower interest. So it's like, it's doubly hard. And it's like, there's something wrong with this. And pawn shops and all that just irritate me because somebody is actually taking advantage of somebody's predicament to make serious amounts of money. And there's something about that that just stinks. So if you own a pawn shop, don't let me know about it. Or lower your interest rate. Okay, yeah. If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it by sunset. So how do you like that? During the day, you take it, then he comes by, picks up his cloak, and goes home. And in the morning, he drops it off again until that thing is settled. What else can they sleep in? When they cry out to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. Well, I love that. Right in the middle of the Book of the Covenant, where he's just given the Decalogue, he's now talking about how much he cares for people and how compassionate he is. And then, I'm compassionate. Here's the next one. Do not blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people. So what command is that kind of touching on?
Number one.
Okay. Don't bear false witness.
Honor your parents.
Honor your father and your mother. What else? Right. Pray for them. And it doesn't imply there that we pray that they die.
No.
Ah, you don't mean that. I'm not saying you mean that. But some people mean that. Yeah, I am praying for them every day. Well, what are you praying? That they come down with some strange, undiagnosable disease and they pass away. No, that's not what you're supposed to pray.
Romans 13 says specifically, honor the civil authorities.
Exactly. So he's connecting to this. So we have honor your mother, your father. We have, how about don't take the name of the Lord in vain. Don't carry it. Don't misrepresent him in any way, speech-wise or otherwise. And so don't blaspheme God. And that's to attribute to God something he hasn't done. So that would be the bearing false witness. Right? Insurance companies do that all the time. There's a hurricane. And it's a act of God. How do they know? Did they talk with him and he confessed? What? How do they know this? No, they're just. Now, what if he didn't do that? What are they doing? They're attributing falsely to God something that he didn't do. So we have to be careful. Sometimes we blame the Lord for stuff that he had nothing to do with, and we have to be careful with that. Well, back here earlier, it says this happened and the Lord allowed it when somebody accidentally died. Well, did the Lord allow Abel to die? Sure he did. Cain was plotting his murder and God knew it. Cain took him out. What happens if God stops everything he knows is sin? Huh? Then you don't have free will. So this is the problem. There are things that God does allow because that's just the nature of the deal. He's given freedom. He's permitted freedom. And with freedom comes consequences. Responsibility and consequences are involved at that. Okay, so do not hold back offerings from your granaries or your vats. How about, where does that apply? About worship the Lord your God and Him alone. Because you have a choice. Jesus says you have a choice. You'll either love God or
money.
Right? So what good happens from giving offerings? It breaks the stingy off of you. It reminds you of who is it really it is and who it really belongs to. And it's a form of worship. You're ascribing the worth of God to him rather than to the money. And so,
the earth is the Lord's, all the fullness thereof.
And all the fullness thereof. You must give me the firstborn of your sons. Do the same with your cattle and your sheep. Let them stay with their mothers for 7 days, but give them to me on the eighth day. So, on the firstborn of the sons, what was significant about the eighth day? What happened when a son was born? On the eighth day, what did they do?
Circumcised
them. Dedicated, devoted them to the Lord. Okay? So offer them to the Lord. This is my firstborn son. I want his life to count for you, not as an, because what would you want to do as a man? This is my firstborn son. He's going to be the one who's going to lead the family. He's going to take over my business. He's going to be the first one. He's going to do this. And what's the Lord saying? How about if you give that one to me? That doesn't mean take him and kill him, by the way. You may feel like that later. But to dedicate him to you. And what do you do with your cattle and your sheep? Now you sacrifice them. You give them to the temple. Yes, Rick. At this point in time, that's not clear. Now remember that he wants them, according to his intention, he wants all of Israel to be a royal priesthood. A kingdom of priests, which means that he wants, at this point, what are we getting? I want all of your males, your firstborn males, to be consecrated to me. That's of every tribe. Later on, that's modified, isn't it? But that's not how it starts out. That's my point. As we read this, we see that they're like, oh no, we don't want to do that. And there's a modification. Okay? And so it comes down to then the Levites. And then they are to redeem their firstborn sons. But that's not how it starts out in the book of the covenant. This covenant I have with you, because there's still some events to come we're going to get into in these next couple weeks. Which reminds me, before we close this out, because we're going to go 23 and 24, and things are really going to get interesting there. But this is that mishmash that we kind of have to make heads or tails of. And I am going to be gone Sunday through Sunday next week. I'll be back Sunday here, but I'll be gone Sunday through Friday. So I won't be here Tuesday next week. So we either get a video or take the week off. I think Rex is going to be in Puerto Rico. I'm going to check with him and see if he's going to be back. So I'll let you know by text, but I was just going to let you know. So I might have him just pick up the 23rd chapter. But I'm not going to let him go into the 24th chapter because there's some candy sticks in there, and I don't want him to have any of those candy sticks. Okay. Okay. So those are for me to share with you. Okay. So wrapping this up. You are to be my holy people. There it is. You. How about this? Y'all. All y'all. So he's reiterating it, right? I want all of you to be my holy people. The ones who are set apart to me. The ones who are consecrated to me. The ones who are a peculiar people on all the earth. You're different from everybody else. Not because you're weird, strange, and goofy. But because I'm forming a culture out of you. And I'm going to bring you into a new culture that's my culture. And I'm taking you out of a culture and bringing you into a culture. Okay? And I'm going to change that. I'm going to change everything. But how many of you know they would have a culture shock and all die at the mountain if he said, now, here's the culture of heaven and you're going to do all of this. They would be like, not us. We're out. Right? We can't handle this. They would all implode in a screaming pile of goo right there in front of the mountain. So he starts laying this on them. You must give me the firstborn of your sons. Do the same with your cattle and your sheep. Let them stay with their mothers for 7 days, but give them to me on the eighth day. You are to be my holy people. So do not eat the meat of an animal torn by wild beasts. Throw it to the dogs. Doesn't it seem like a hodgepodge of thoughts? Yeah, by the way, don't eat meat. Don't eat roadkill. Don't eat lion kill. Don't eat wild buffalo kill. Whatever. Don't eat that. Something's been bit by a snake and fallen down. Something's been torn by wild beasts. And you come up. They're traveling. So are they going to see roadkill? Yeah. Now, there's sickness in these wild beasts, but I'm going to provide for you. You're my people, so I will provide for you, and that is not my provision. That is not my provision. That thing that smells funny, and that, you know, that the wild dingoes have taken, you know, nope, that's not it. That's not it. And so, And it's going to get into great detail on this, but it seems like a hodgepodge, like, where this is just kind of coming out of left field. But they're in the desert, they see roadkill, they see things torn by wild beasts, they're walking and they're scaring away things that are running off and leaving a carcass. So he's saying, don't do it. I'll take care of you, I'll provide for you, you're my people, and I know how to take care of you, and I'll take good care of you. And I want you to be consecrated to myself. I don't want you to be sick. I don't want, he says, take that and throw it to the dogs. Now, in that culture, this is not an American culture. Because we would say, not my dog. My dog gets iams. I nothing but the best for Fifi. Don't you give him, I used to tease Tosh all the time and say, now wait a minute, isn't it the wishbone we want to give the dog? And stuff like that. Because, no, don't give them any chicken bones. It'll get sideways in their throat. You know, stuff. And so, that used to be the ongoing joke at the table. No, you don't give them any of that. Because that dog could die. And so, sometimes I say, that dog needs to eat some chicken bones. So, but we're very sensitive about our dogs. This was not so in the Middle East. There was the one dog that was seen and worshipped by the Egyptians. But they were pack animals, and they were the ones that took care of the falling carcasses. They got the dirty and nasty stuff. And dogs will still eat disgusting things, won't they? Everybody knows it. No matter how high bred they are and how much they cost, they still think that nasty piece of whatever in the ground is just wonderful. It's worth digging after. And so, in scripture, dogs are seen as unclean, and they do unclean stuff. And so, when to call somebody a dog was not a high compliment at all. And so he says, the man's best friend thing was not going on, in that day. I know we're different, and I'm not saying we're wrong. I'm saying sometimes we exalt our dogs to an extent we shouldn't, but, he says, throw it to the dogs. It's unclean. Leave it alone. Get away from it. Yeah, and the proverb is true that a dog returns to its vomit. So, unclean, nasty. With that, we'll end with the word of prayer, and everybody can go home with that as the last thought in their head tonight. Right? So what we're getting is the Ten Commandments, and then we're getting some practical applications of how this works out in your life, as sneaky and tricky as you are as Israelites, God's people coming out of Egypt, having lived there for 400 years and mostly living like an Egyptian, not living like the people of God. And God is saying, I'm going to set some things in place to get you out of Egypt and get the Egypt out of you. I'm going to get the Egypt out of you, and I'm going to lead you in a direction. So when somebody says, well, yeah, the God of the Old Testament, you know, he supported slavery. No, he dealt with slavery because that was the reality of every culture. He did not institute it and celebrate it. He actually put it on the road to extinction is what he actually did. But you have to change those cultures. What do you know how to change a culture? Like boiling frogs. You raise the temperature 1 degree at a time or else they will jump out of the kettle. Now, I didn't do that experiment, so nobody get mad. But that's the old boiling frog analogy. Don't raise the temperature too much. Just slowly, 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 and you can change and reshape the culture. That can happen negatively for you, by the way, as a believer. Because the enemy can constantly get you acculturated to things that are not godly. And you'll start to buy into them. That's how the enemy works us. But the Lord also has to work us, take us away, wean us off, and draw us away from our old ways, our old paths, our old habits, and transform us and make us new. It's a constant process, isn't it? It's a process of calling us aside to Himself. And we see it right there as it's a working out of the Ten Commandments into the Book of the Covenant. So Lord, we just love You. We just thank You as we go through what seems to be a hodgepodge and a mishmash of different thoughts that seem to almost conflict, that You're giving us a glimpse into their culture, into the way that You change a culture from their situation towards glory. We thank You for Your patience. We thank You that You're so long-suffering towards us, Word. And we just open our hearts to You once again, Lord, and say thank You, that You want us to be Your consecrated people, a people after Your own heart. And we just invite You to challenge us by this in our own heart and life. Lord, where do we hold on to some things from Egypt we just need to release? Where are some things in us that are persisting from our past and from the darkness that need to come into Your glorious light? And You will shine the light of truth into us, Lord. You can bring us as the schoolmaster toward Christ, and we can come and say, You're right, Lord. I am messed up. I do think incorrectly. But rather than being condemned, we can rejoice that You brought us into the light and that You have an answer of peace to turn us and change us into righteousness. And we thank You for that in Jesus' name. Amen.